Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Roguecast episode 290, recorded March 10th, 2020. Raptor Robin versus the Three Jokers.
It's a podcast. We're all tired.
Yes, we did inventory yesterday and expended all of our energy for the whole week on it.
Right, so this podcast is mostly going to be us talking, just like this, in a monotone voice with no changes of any kind.
Speak for yourself, gentlemen. I've got comedy gold awaiting.
Oh, good.
If I start snoring, it's okay.
It's also a lighter than usual week for me. I don't know, you guys probably found some stuff. I had a little trouble. I did find something. Light on the news for the store as far as things go. Like, we don't have anything big coming up until the Magic pre-release in April.
Yeah, I know we're about to do our aren't we about to do our D&D painting thing?
We have a painting event on Saturday. Yep.
Yeah, but that's already full up, so we can't really promote it. But it is neat, and people should look at the cool dragon that Nick is no doubt going to paint.
Also, that's not this Saturday; it's next Saturday.
Is it?
Yep.
It's the 14th.
Yep.
That's this Saturday, isn't it?
This is Saturday.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate. Okay.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunate. Well, that's going to cause some havoc.
Yeah, we just realized this tweak messes with the schedule I believe we had planned.
Uh-huh. Quite a bit, actually. Yeah.
Well, we'll figure something out.
You're learning. You're hearing it live, folks. You see, the staff gets this all the time with the Randy makes the schedule. We didn't pay enough attention to it.
To be fair, we are all addled from doing inventory and can't be expected to make normal decisions or understand consequences.
Or time.
Or time.
We were all here for 12 hours yesterday.
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're setting it, counting everything in the store, it's a lot.
Oh, I think I lost my brain a little counting numbers on miniatures.
Yeah,
that's where I lost it.
I lost it inputting millions of numbers into our computer.
Ones and zeros, yes.
Ones and zeros. Anyway, so don't expect a lot of us this week is what I'm saying. Russell, you have to carry this one. Take it away.
Listen, I've got comedy gold for people.
All right, David,
let's hit us up with some trailers or whatever it is we're talking about.
All right. The first thing up is that we got our first look at the Batmobile that Matt Reeves is going to be... Matt Reeves. What's his name? Robert Pattinson is going to be driving around.
Yes.
Matt Reeves is directing it.
Matt Reeves, he'll probably drive it. If you're directing a Batmobile, you'd drive the Batmobile.
If I was on this set, I would totally drive the Batmobile.
Yeah.
I think the new Batmobile looks cool.
It does.
It's not bad. It looks like a car instead of a tank, and I'm good with that.
Yeah.
It looks like the...
What was the meme I saw? Does it come in car?
But it reminds me of, what, it was during the Alan Grant, Norm Breifogel thing?
Norm Breifogel's look, for sure. He had that sort of Camaro-esque look.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Was it a Camaro, like Lamborghini?
Yeah,
this
Lamborghini
has a little bit of a Mustang vibe, too.
It was a muscle car.
Yeah, but it's got some Batman detailing and gear on it. I'm going to guess that... I'm trying to tell... Is the idea that it could pass for not Batmobile when it's not all, like, geared up and, like, you know, going at high speeds and shooting cables?
Maybe that's the case. I don't know.
When I first started, early on in my DC reading, when John Byrne was doing that Man of Steel miniseries and he crossed over with Batman, he kind of made out that the Batman didn't have the Batmobile yet in it. So he had, like, this kind of dark sedan that had, like, this high-tech crime computer, like, built into the trunk and stuff. He had, like, cool stuff in it, but it was not the Batmobile, which is a little weird, but I kind of liked it as a Batman Year One sort of vibe.
Yeah.
This is a little past that. This is clearly, it's a Batmobile.
It's a Batmobile.
But it's going to be, it's not like a giant crazy dragster with gothic armoring on it, which is what we've been used to since at least 1989.
Yep.
Anyway, I think it looks cool. I feel like most of the reactions have been solidly positive.
Yeah.
Some people, I think, want a more extravagant Batmobile, and I get that. I think I like extravagant Batmobiles, too. But I'm glad to break away from the tank look.
Yeah.
The giant armored killing machine.
Yep.
Is not really my
Batman. Plus, we were given the first look of Batman with a cape instead of on a motorcycle with no cape.
Yeah. Isn't there kind of a weird collar thing going on that almost looks a little Gotham by Gaslight sort of thing?
Oh, I didn't notice that.
I might be wrong. I couldn't quite tell. I wasn't sure, like, if he has different looks and stuff like that.
Are you talking Jim Lee collar?
More like, this is weird. It's more like it kind of a big Victorian-looking collar sort of thing. Oh. I don't know, where the cape, instead of just flowing into the cowl, it's like, it's like it's got a little flip down, almost like a Buccaneer boots neck collar.
What if he's wearing Buccaneer boots?
I mean, you mean like on his neck, though?
Oh, I mean, neck Buccaneer boots.
Neck forever.
Yes, I mean.
No, I don't think so, because the look of his bat armor is pretty Arkham video game style. It's still segmented metallic armor.
What if there's time travel and he is Gotham by gaslight?
All right.
What if the Batmobile has a flux capacitor in it?
So these guys didn't get a lot of sleep, is what you have to understand.
I'm talking. If
he's gonna do that, he should go to like the island that time forgot and like fight dinosaurs and stuff.
And pick up an elf sidekick to be Robin.
Although I guess you wouldn't necessarily need to, because the island that time forgot can be in any time.
You said island that time forgot. I went to Island of Misfit Toys.
Ah.
And I thought maybe he was gonna.
Wasn't sure what you meant by
what
you said.
I thought he was
gonna
pick up Hermie the elf, who always wanted to be a dentist, but instead is going to be the sidekick to.
And I went to what, Dinosaur Island? I mean,
the island that time forgot in DC is like a dinosaur island.
So what if he gets a raptor to be his next Robin?
I mean, that's awesome. Raptor Robin?
Yeah.
I don't got anything.
Get him, chum.
Oh, my God. The Joker did not last long against him.
The Joker was disemboweled and eaten.
He should have been carrying a raptor around long ago.
Yeah, that crowbar did not help him against the raptor. Anyway.
So we like the Batmobile.
Yeah. Speaking of Joker, DC just reannounced the thing that they've been talking about, the three Jokers.
Right. This was a story concept that goes back to the, I think, like quarter issue or dollar issue that launched Rebirth, the Rebirth line, right? Yep. And they promised this story in which there was somehow three different Jokers, as if, I don't know, it was almost like there's the cartoonish Joker, and then there's the serial killer Joker, and then there's, I don't know, maybe somewhere in between
the
Jack Nicholson or the 1970s-ish Joker.
So apparently, originally it was going to be part of Geoff Johns' Killing Zone imprint. It's a terrible idea.
Did that imprint ever even happen?
It did not. Instead, it's going to be in Black Label.
Okay.
And
Black Label, a.k.a. the label of plausible deniability.
Yep. And in 2018, what John said is, it's not about other dimensions or other Earths. It's a very grounded emotional story. This will explore a new facet of who Bruce Wayne is that's never been seen in comics. It connects him to the Joker in a way that will change their relationship forever. So the Joker's his brother?
The Joker is Jack Napier.
Joker is actually his father.
Well, I mean, the Joker movie played around with some of those ideas.
Yeah, but that was dumb.
I don't like
it. I'm just saying, it's out there in the culture.
Yep. I can see them doing that. It'd be terrible.
Well, but again, like, Black Label is one where... Is there something going on in Black Label that's, like, in continuity, isn't there? Is there any...
No, all the Joker stuff is theoretically lightly in continuity. The Harley Quinn that just came out, the Harley Quinn and Birds of Prey, is sort of in continuity with the Harley Quinn.
But nothing that's definitively in continuity?
No, but nothing is definitively out of it either. I mean, I guess it's alternate futures.
They could reference it if they wanted.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't think any of us were like had been waiting the last five years.
Some people are very excited about this.
But some people have been waiting for it. I think, those serial killers?
Yep.
No, some people like the Joker and they just want some more creepy Joker stories. I understand.
Yeah. Anyway, three Jokers might be able to take on one Raptor Robin. We'll see.
do they have a date for this?
June.
June. Okay, yeah, wow. So like we're about to be ordering this.
Yep. It's crazy.
Yeah. I thought that for sure that they were just going to let that story just disappear into the
ether. Me too.
As surely as like if Kevin Smith had written it.
It disappeared like a puff of weed smoke.
What if that's what Nightcrawler smelled like when he like bamped around? Maybe after a night of partying he does.
Especially on Krakoa nowadays, yeah.
I definitely feel like Krakoa is probably like growing its own super weed.
Totally.
Alright,
there's news of a Sandman audio drama. I didn't follow much of this, Dave.
I don't know. I didn't realize I was going to get quizzed on it. DC and I think like Audible, if I'm not mistaken, are doing an audio drama based on Neil Gaiman's Sandman. And I don't know if it's just one story in there or if they're going to try and dramatize a big thing, the full thing. But to me, it sounded like, although the little Flash animated video that I watched had Neil Gaiman describing the premise of it in a way that almost sounded like like it was a like an official opening to it, not just a him right. like sitting down in an office talking, but it was like the Sandman is the world is a world of blah blah blah. Like it sounded like the opening of Lord of the Rings kind of stuff.
Okay.
And but I don't think he himself is like going to be reading this aloud, even though he reads a lot of his own books on aloud on Audible. I believe this is actually going to be a audio drama with different voices for all the different characters. He gave the premise of who the Dreaming are and death and destiny and all that stuff.
There's a long history of Neil Gaiman and audio dramas.
Yeah.
I mean, all of his... I mean, Neverwhere got one. Actually, two. It started as an audio drama, then moved to a book, and then it went to another audio drama.
I didn't know that.
Well, An American Gods is like a full production audio book with all different voices and casts.
Oh, they did that with that one, too?
Yeah, it wasn't actually like an audio play, but it was... The audio, it was the audiobook as read. They basically cast the voices and stuff.
I don't have much experience with the audio drama side of Neil Gaiman stuff, but I did try. I was curious, and I listened to like a little bit of a BBC production of an audio drama of his Norse mythology one, where they took it, and of course that's not like a, you know, it's heavily a narrator kind of book, but with occasional lines of dialogue. It is amazing when Neil Gaiman reads it for the Audible book. For it. It's like one of the best ones things I've ever heard as an audiobook. But when I listened to the audio drama, it was lame. It was like kind of, I thought, weakly written. I hope it didn't sound like Gaiman had done it himself. It sounded like somebody else had adapted it, added in a bunch of dialogue, given some, there's a new framing device where like children are being told these Norse tales and they were like annoying little kids.
Adapted by Scott Lobdell.
And so... that my one experience with it, I was like, boo. I'm like, I just want like him to read maybe an adaptation of his own work.
Hopefully, the
Norse mythology comic?
No, I thought, didn't like Amazon pick it up? Don't they have the rights for the Norse mythology?
I think there is something like that,
TV series?
Mm.
We'll see.
Honestly, I like it best as stories told. Like, I think that, like, is like actually fits the format. It's supposed to be, you know, even he in his introduction to the Norse mythology thing talks about these sort of, these being stories to tell around a fire kind of thing. And the idea of making it a, like, expanding it into a drama, I don't really like it. But...
I'd be interested to see how they do the Sandman, because it's very visual.
Yeah, and Sandman has a lot of different types of stories, too. It's not just about the Endless. It's a lot of times about... kind of like a wide variety of people, ranging from sort of normal people to weird serial killer people. Yep.
And what was that serial killer's name with the teeth for eyes?
Corinthian.
Yeah. The Corinthian. Yeah.
One of the creepier people ever to be conceived in a comic.
Yep. Sure.
Anyway, but I like, you said there have been other examples that like he's done frequent audio dramas, and it sounds like some of them have been more successful than the one I randomly listened to. Yeah. So I'm going to be trying to be open-minded on it. I would like to see what gets done with it.
Taika Waititi seems to be in developing mode, as he is developing two new animated Willy Wonka TV shows for Netflix. Write, direct, and executive produce.
Did you say two?
Two.
Yes.
So one of them is going to be about Willy Wonka, and the other one is going to be about the Oompa Loompas.
Interesting. Did people finally decide it was a little weird that the Oompa Loompas were like slaves or something?
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird.
He'll probably touch on that.
I actually, I do love Willy Wonka. I love the old Gene Wilder movie, and I also love the book.
It's a weird, weird story.
I mean, it's a bit odd.
A Taika Waititi animated Oompa Loompa series sounds like a ton of fun. Like, we've seen his sort of reverent take on, like, vampires and stuff with what he did in the shadows. I could see him doing basically an Oompa Loompa workplace comedy.
Sure.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Because most people, you tell me they're doing that, I would be horrified. But I think actually the Taika Waititi could pull that
off. Are these
off.
Both animated things?
Both animated.
Oh, weird. I think I would prefer a live action-y thing, but maybe.
We shall see.
Only as long as Rhys Darby is involved in some fashion.
That's true.
Nick, you just saw, what was it recently? Jojo Rabbit?
Yes.
And liked that quite a bit,
quite
right?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then HBO is developing a Last of Us TV show based on the video game, and it is being developed by Craig Mazin, who did Chernobyl, along with Neil Druckmann, who is the guy who created Last of Us.
Yeah, that sounds like the creator of Chernobyl doing a post-apocalyptic adventure sounds as delightful as The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
You know, Mazin was the guy who did the Watchmen podcast for them, though. Uh-huh. And he was the sort of the guy who sort of walked. He was the host basically,
uh-huh.
and walked Lindelof through and all that stuff. And you can tell this guy is a consummate like storyteller thinker.
Okay,
like he definitely comes off as one of these creatives. You're like, oh, I would trust this guy to do some interesting stuff.
His involvement, this is blasphemous. I never finished Last of Us. I got frustrated with it, and I never returned to it.
I've never played it. Even though I think it would be up my alley. Everything I hear about it makes me think I would like it.
I started with it, enjoyed it, but I didn't finish it either.
I will be interested to see if they continue, or if they start it where it does start, because it does start in Austin, Texas.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the opening cutscene is in Austin.
Nick, did you stop playing it because you weren't enjoying it, or did you stop playing it because it was grim, or that it was too hard, or...
No, the grimness stuff, I mean, it very much plays out like a zombie apocalypse kind of thing.
Okay.
But, and that's neither here nor there. You know my stance on zombies.
Well, then that's not here, neither here nor there. That's a knock against it for you.
It is a knock. But the frustration level kind of was the thing that killed it for me, is like... I made a bad save.
It requires
can save in random spots, and I saved where I was low on health after I just got through something else.
Yeah. I understand this is a game that has like a lot of stealth components and don't use your ammo. And when we were talking about Metal Gear the other day, you told me that you shoot up every all the scenes and you don't do the stealth stuff.
Not all the time.
That's what you said.
But yes, I do like to. I am not like great at stealth.
Well, sometimes I will say this. Those Metal Gear games, although I do love them all, are wildly unforgiving. Like, if somebody spots you, like in other video games that use stealth stuff, you can hide and like 30 seconds later, as long as you don't do anything stupid, you're out doing cool stuff again. Man, in Metal Gear, they want you to like lock it down for like 5 minutes of real time waiting for the guards to go back to their patterns and stuff like that, because they stay on like a heightened mode for like 2 or 3 minutes.
I'm a big fan of if you do the stealth thing and you find out you have a little bar that goes down, and then at the end of that you know you're free to go again. That is my favorite way of doing that. Or just shooting everything around.
But the thing about the interesting thing is Last of Us was beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Like it was a really interesting post, because it was zombie-ish, but not.
But it was like vegetative like plant zombies. Plant.
And it was, and
it was it based like, on like those. I think it was based on that weird fungus that makes ants into zombies.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it was sort of like nature reclaiming society and that kind of stuff.
Right. So you got these overgrown landscapes.
So the notion of the guy who did Chernobyl doing it makes a lot of sense. So I'm curious.
It's his visual aesthetic,
and I think he'll do something more interesting than the "we're the real monsters in the apocalypse" thing that everybody does with zombies.
Well, HBO, pretty much anything they do, I'll check out regardless of.
That said, this is still a video game property.
It's right.
You know what I was just thinking, although I've not plugged into it, I know you have, The Witcher has been one of the more successful video game property adaptations.
It's actually true.
I don't know if I can... Are there any other TV shows that have adapted ones that have worked out well?
I can't think of any, but I mean, there aren't any.
I mean, like, the Castlevania animated thing seems to be pretty well received.
I mean, I've watched the first couple,
So I guess there may be some stuff percolating.
Wait a minute. TV adapts video games better.
TV may be the place for video games to go. That makes sense.
Maybe I can finally get my Frogger.
You kind of blew my mind now. I'm like, Witcher is better than Mortal Kombat.
No.
Witcher wishes it could match Johnny Cage, but it cannot. Goro beats it down.
The last thing we were talking about is the new trailer from Lord Miller for Sony Animation called Connected, which I think Dave... is not maybe Lord Miller person in general.
Yeah, I don't think...
You like the Lego movie, though, right?
I haven't seen the Lego movie.
What?
I haven't seen any of the Lego movies or the Batman movie, even though Nick very kindly gave me one of them or his...
Oh, that's right. And even though you can appreciate Into the Spider-Verse, you are a person who does not love it the way they do.
Yeah, correct. Right. I'm sort of... I admire their craft from a distance, but the Lego movies are too goofy for me, and honestly, Into the Spider-Verse was a little too goofy for me. But there's like... Actually, there's stuff in there that I'm watching. I actually... Just like a Sunday or two back, I remember going up to you and saying, oh man, this is so amazing what they do here. Being super impressed with it.
Yep. But Nick is a Lord Miller aficionado.
Yeah, I like all their projects.
And I generally like them, but I'm kind of waiting for them to stumble because they've been doing way too much stuff, and I feel like this might be their stumble.
See, I just think this is like a miscut trailer, because I think the concept beyond it of a family sort of trying to get away from technology and connect with one another.
And then the singularity happens.
And then the singularity happens and machines rise up for only for them to fight. I think it's a fun concept.
Do we say that this is like this is a computer generated movie like a Pixar type thing?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not computer generated. This is made by people.
Yes.
What if the singularity?
Computer animated, I guess I would say.
The singularity is not
the singular made it in order to teach the, yeah. the humans that
get
there is
ready,
no.
humans.
It seems like the core premise involves a dad who's a kind of a nice typical dad guy who's a. Had a close connection with his daughter growing up, but finds that she hits her teens and she's on her phone a lot and all of that stuff. Watching YouTube, doing goofy, what do you call it when you take pictures and you've got a, and you turn into
selfie?
A dog?
Or no.
Yeah, what do you call it? Filters.
Snapchat filters.
Snapchat. Filters, yes. She's doing all that stuff and they're not sort of connecting anymore. And so she's going off to what, college?
College, yeah.
And he's like, instead of you flying there, we're going to have a family road trip and we're going to connect. And then the robot singularity happens in a somewhat comical way, not yeah. in a grim, dark, serious yeah. way. But, like, robots are loose, and it looks like somehow this family will be at the heart of trying to stop it together. No doubt, as they become more connected, like the title says.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Or, if this was, in fact, made by computers, they all die 10 minutes into the singularity, and the robots spend the next 20 minutes talking to us flesh bags about how good things are going to be.
They will sing the Humans Are Dead from yes. Flight of the Conchords. Great song, great show if you haven't seen it.
And then Argon Gas will release into every theater, and we'll all die, and the robots will take over.
We use poisonous gases, and we poison their asses.
Got dark.
Anyway,
and
yeah,
the Ghost
I just...
The Connection will be the last movie you ever see.
To me, it actually... I
Not
got
Dave,
the,
though. He'll be fine.
That's right. I got the same vibe from this that I did in the trailer for... What's the one that's out from Disney or Pixar?
Onward.
What's it called?
Onward.
Onward, yeah. They're kind of modern urban fantasy-ish kind
yeah,
of
yep,
thing.
Yep.
Which is to say, it didn't make me laugh a whole lot. It looked solidly made. But it didn't look like something I would want to catch.
Yeah.
Nick, you gonna catch it?
I'm not sure, actually.
Okay.
It's possible.
I'm pretty likely to Randy. See this.
Interesting, Randy. You were unimpressed with the trailer, but...
Oh, I thought
yeah.
you were talking about Onward. I'll go see this. This looks
okay.
fun.
No, Onward I'm 100% going to see. This one I'll probably see because I have kids.
Yeah.
And even though they're getting older, one of them still wants to go see these movies, so...
That's fair enough.
Yeah. So, all right. That's news for the week. Wow. I'm tired.
Yeah, we're all a little tired.
And
the words not come out right sometimes.
Words no speak book. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of March 11th. And I think the most notable thing for me this week is actually not my pick. But I do want to give a shout-out to the History of the Marvel Universe Treasury Edition thing that came out this week.
Yeah, that is the oversized collection of Mark Waid's kind of 2020 hindsight Marvel telling of Marvel's history.
Yeah.
The Treasury Edition, that style is so cool. They did that for the Silver Surfer Black.
Yeah.
And it's just a great format for it because the art just gets to breathe. And this is... Is this Javier Rodriguez?
Yes, and it's gorgeous. Yeah.
For those who didn't see it when it was coming out in single issues, it was like, what, a 4 or 6 issue miniseries? That in which Galactus, like near the end of his lifespan in the far-flung future, is talking to, I believe, Reed Richards?
Franklin
Richards' kid.
And it is the end of the universe that's about to go full Big Bang and create a new universe.
And it's a little bit of a... high concept thing. It's a contrivance, but essentially, is it Franklin talking or Galactus
it's
talking?
Franklin talking, and Galactus is like, tell me one last bedtime story about the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, and so he kind of covers all of the grand history of the Marvel Universe, all the characters and stuff you care about. There's probably a few you don't care about, but actually, no, it's all really nicely done and kind of merges history, you know, it's including newer retcons things in there. You know, you will have now Deadpool mixed in with classic Marvel history, but, like, all of the, like, Apocalypse is going to show up when they're talking about ancient Egypt. It takes you up through the West, to the modern times, to the far-flung future stuff, Asgard and everything in there.
Two-Gun Kid is definitely in there.
The Celestials, you know, it spans the full Marvel Universe. Like, if you wanted to get a picture of what the Marvel Universe looks like as a whole, if you're one of those folks who's, like, kind of came in through... Civil War or anything like that, and you know, like the kind of history of the Marvel Universe, This is like the big picture book to read.
Oh yeah,
and Mark Waid is perfect for this.
Yeah, I mean, he knows his stuff.
His head is an encyclopedia of Marvel.
That's true.
He's a living Ohatmu.
Yep, I really enjoyed this too, and I'm going to pick it up at some point.
Ohatmu being the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
Yes, any kid in the 80s or what 90s when they did a second version of it. We'll remember these as the before there was Wikipedia, there was actually these better written encyclopedic entries on Marvel heroes and their strengths and weaknesses.
There's like the art that they did for it, and then like the...
aside from getting like a lot of notable artists to do the pinups of the heroes, they used clip art from like some of their coolest adventures.
Yep.
Throughout it.
Then they did, like, tech specs for whatever kind of gear they had.
Elliot R. Brown would draw these, like, cutaway views of, like, the Avengers Mansion or the Punisher's van.
Why is this not in print? I just feel like
it's essentially Wikipedia entries.
Yeah. And also it's out of date.
I don't care. I want that as sort of, like, a snippet of history.
Yeah. They did reprint it, but I think they did those essentials in black and white. Yeah. But I thought they might have done color editions. They probably did at some point, and
Marvel went on to do more of them. But the ones they did after the fact were just kind of ho hum.
It's true. Yeah, they would do ones from like here's our characters from the 60s and 70s. Like they would do, the 70s alone would get a volume, or the 90s or the 2000s or whatever would. But, yeah, they've never quite matched up. They really, I think, in the 80s, when they first conceived of this, they were like, if we're going to do essentially encyclopedia entries on Marvel Heroes, let's make them cool and fun to read.
Yeah.
So each one, you know, they tended to not go more than a page, page and a half for a character's history. And it was like a highlight reel of their biggest stuff. But not, as sometimes happens with Wikipedia's, like if you look up a character's history and that, sometimes you feel like they're trying to cover every single story they were in, and it's actually like too much. So these were like the perfect concise, bite-sized ones.
Yep.
So, and anybody who from the era probably remembers them, you would also, since it would tell how many tons a hero could lift, they would, it was an easy way to kind of at least mentally decide like, who's stronger, Hercules or Thor, or Hulk or Hercules? And, you know, of course they would explain Hulk's power varies. I believe a calm Hulk is not as strong as Hercules. An angry Hulk is much stronger than Hercules.
I believe that's true.
I believe calm Hulk was like 70 tons was their kind of average for him.
Yep.
But anyway, it was cool. It would be nice if they... I kind of wish they would... Even if they were doing modern ones and it had like all the X-Men circa Krakoa and all of that stuff... I wouldn't mind if they did those and just, like, put out one yearly cool book or something like
that. Well, they were doing them for a while, but they did them as, like, one-shots, and they were... And they
that's
were
what I mean.
Them by,
like,
they were not great.
They would need, I think, to like, put as much into making them, like, a perfect thing as they did in the 80s. But I also believe it is simply outmoded by the fact that digital stuff, if there was a strange thing that happened and the characters change a month afterwards, well, you got to wait a year if they were just printing them. And online, you could get that information immediately. So I think people just don't crave the information the way we did. They get information at the drop of a hat.
In my dream world, Marvel would hire, is it Mike Chiarello? Mark Chiarello from DC and have him do a new Ohatmu.
Yeah.
Chiarello's good for art. I think, unfortunately, the guy you're missing is Mark Gruenwald.
There
is no replacement for Mark Gruenwald.
Was he the editor on
Mark
those?
Mark Gruenwald was the editor, and Peter Sanderson was pretty heavily involved. Peter Sanderson's still around, but Gruenwald was the magic ingredient that made Ohatmu work.
Yeah.
But this usually talks so much about flashback stuff because that is kind of what my pick is this week.
Okay.
Which is Marvel Snapshots Submariner. We've been talking this a little bit about how we think this is kind of a weird misread of the market for Marvel to put these out right now.
Yeah, the series is just called Snapshots, right? Or Marvel Snapshots or something?
Marvel Snapshots.
Yeah.
And each one is going to be a one-shot by people that Kurt Busiek has sort of handpicked.
He's the curating force behind this, and they're like... Sort of, this is a bit of an offshoot of his Marvel series from back when, but it's like stories from throughout Marvel's grand tapestry of history by various creators he likes and admires.
So this has Alan Brennert, who is a legendary Batman and science fiction writer, Jerry Ordway, who's a longtime creator.
Oh, yeah.
Doing a story about Namor, the Submariner, who, by the way, I am super bored by usually.
Yes.
I have no love for Submariner whatsoever. But this is viewed through the lens of, as Busiek usually did in the Marvels,
bystander or something?
Betty someone who's his girlfriend.
Okay.
Who was his girlfriend at the time, I guess. She has just come. Her brothers have come back from the war. They're suffering from various forms of ailments or PTSD.
It was like the 1940s.
Yes, indeed.
World War II.
She goes to an amusement park with Namor to try and sort of cheer him up, and realizes that Namor has also developed PTSD from events suffered during the war. A Nazi shark shows up to someone shows up in Nazi shark battle armor to ransack the place. Namor goes crazy. There's a big fight, and his girlfriend is forced to call in the All-Winter Squad to keep his temper down, keep him from just wrecking the whole place and taking out these Nazis.
Okay.
In amongst that, it is about sort of the after effects of being at war, about whether heroes kill or not, whether Submariner is a hero or not. Like, it's really interesting. It's all viewed from the lens of his girlfriend. Ordway's art is really nice.
You know what's interesting?
Renner's story has a lot of character stuff. What's that?
That, even though I suspect there's no, like, really big overlap between this story and the story that, say, Chip Zdarsky was telling in his, did he do an Invaders book, or what was it?
Oh, yeah, Invaders, yeah.
His Invaders book, but it seems like they both, I think, touch on the idea that Namor suffered from PTSD, and I like this idea. I think it makes him more interesting as a character, and honestly, because he's been sort of awkwardly written and he changes sometimes with each author, it kind of gives him explain sort of mood swings and why he might be going one direction one month and one direction another month. But it's just interesting to me that Brennert, who probably is not reading Zdarsky's run,
nope,
also picked up on a similar vibe. I kind of like it.
Yeah. It's a really good one shot. Again, I'm not quite sure who the audience is for this, but it turns out I'm in that audience. If you are too, you might pick this up.
Yeah. Jerry Ordway's always killing it on the art too. I think people who might remember him from, like, drawing one of the Superman, the Adventures of Superman book back when the post-crisis DC.
Yeah. 40 years ago.
Yep. But he also did the Power of Shazam,
yep,
and had a great pulp look,
yep,
for that.
Yep.
He's been on and off active in the industry, but I feel like those are kind of some of his big ones. And that Power of Shazam stuff, especially the painted graphic novel
that
he did.
Really nice.
Really nice.
Dave, what you got?
As y'all know, I occasionally pick, when they do these Jim Henson storyteller miniseries, I'll occasionally pick an issue of it. They are doing a new one called Jim Henson Storyteller Ghosts. They have previously done one on other sort of mythological or fantasy themes. So there was one on dragons, one on giants. And when I say one, it's a four-issue miniseries,
mm-hmm,
each issue being a standalone thing that tells a new story about those things that feels like it could be like a lost legend or something. But it's always original. It's like they're not going to tell you the story when they were doing the giants one of like some real Norse giant or like a John Henry era folktale about a giant or something like that.
So this is going to be like four standalone stories?
Four standalone.
There's no connection?
Never a connection.
Interesting, okay.
The only connection, and this is only thematic, or is the story is always told by this old codger talking to his dog, which clearly was the format on the TV show that inspired it called Jim Henson's Storyteller, where I don't know if the dog might have actually been like a Muppet kind of thing.
I think the dog was a Muppet.
Yeah, and so anyway, this one is a little unusual because the ghosts theme is darker than they normally do. But the story and art in this is by somebody named Mark Laszlo, and I don't know who that is, but that's not unusual. I usually don't know who the creators are on these storytellers ones. I can only say that the art reminds me very much, check this out, Randy, of like Hellboy and BPRD type stuff.
Oh yeah, I see that. Who's the artist?
So much so that he's the artist as well. So much so that, like if you've seen Guy Davis's work on BPRD,
yeah,
this has a kinship with it. And so he's talking to his dog early on about an unusual kind of ghost, which you will find is a strange child ghost called a Myling. Now, I bet this is not even a real thing. Like, if you look it up, although it is set in Scandinavia, so it could be.
Yeah.
Like, Myling, Myling. He tells the story of this kind of dark story about some twins that are born sort of as a secret liaison years ago or hundreds of years ago between like a servant girl at a kind of larger but isolated estate sort of thing in Scandinavia. Not quite. It looks a little Viking times-ish. She had twins with the son of her master, And they, he's, the Master is so put off when he discovers it, though they try to hide it, that they leave the kids out to die of exposure in the woods. Without saying too much, one of them dies. And another person, another one was found by a woman who takes and raises them, raises the kid as her own. And, but the other one sort of becomes the ghost. And there is an interesting link that will happen decades later as the one is grown up and is actually, in fact, himself become an old man. It's a sad story, but interesting. It's like really quite dark. The ending isn't super dark. The ending has a certain hopefulness to it. But the dog remarks, "Wow, that." But the dog speaks. I should say. The dog says,
"I picked up on that."
Wow, that really was a grim story. after it was over. Anyway, that's what I liked about it is that although I'm used to these having sometimes a melancholy tone, sometimes a like a Pyrrhic victory, this one really was pretty dark. And I respect that they did that because the theme is ghosts. And you know what it reminded me of most? The Guillermo del Toro style in show movies like Mama and things like that.
Yeah.
Which is to say that there is a certain it's not like quite morose or grim, but it is dark. It is dark and very human, and he finds those human moments. Anyway, I would be interested to see what else this guy does. But as always, I'm just interested to see how this series comes along too. It'll be a different creator next issue, so I won't get more of the same dude. But off to a good start, certainly with the creepy baby ghost story.
Very cool.
And I just to reiterate, it's really beautifully drawn. It has that BPRD creepy look, but that's kind of creepy cool. Again, that's a Guillermo del Toro thing. The way the ghost looks in Mama is creepy, but kind of cool too.
Well, the cover to it is definitely kind of evokes a certain creepiness.
Yes, there is an old man carrying a ghostly baby on his back with a sort of giant head. It's as if it's a giant baby ghost.
I was thinking like a pop ghost, like those pop figures.
Don't ruin it, Nick. Don't ruin it by bringing Funko to it. Nick, what do you have for us this week?
Another week, another X book.
Okay. It's a new next X
book. This actually is. This is Cable number one. I'm not the world's biggest Cable fan. I guess like all
however,
90s kids.
In this room, you might be the biggest Cable fan in the room.
That's true. It's possible. Yeah. Although I think you bought more copies of X-Force number one than I did.
That's true, but I was a dumb kid.
I was my mom now, only bought me one.
When I'm adultish adult.
Now, Cable, as and most current X fans know, is not the grizzled old warrior that we know him as.
No, he is Kid Cable, who is a Cable from the future who came back and killed his old past self because he was screwing up the timeline.
Interesting. He's not literally called Kid Cable.
He's just called Cable.
Just our little pet name when we're being mean.
It's the same way when I called Kid Vulcan. Although,
but you actually like this, and Kid Vulcan was a character in Ed Brubaker's run that we hated.
Yeah, that's true. Still hate him, even though he shows up in X-Men this week.
Yeah, so, don't say hate in the past tense.
So tell me, tell me about this new Cable. What is he like as a kid?
I want to talk about the art first, because it's Phil Noto. Phil Noto is a great artist, I think.
He does painted art.
He doesn't do a ton of stuff, but he, I think, lasted like a Black Widow series for a little while.
Yep.
He does amazing covers. This cover that he does for the first issue of Cable is like all 80s action movie, or even 70s action, late 70s era action movie.
Poster. For sure. By the way, I realize we call him a kid. He's, what, like 18, 20?
He's like 20.
Yeah.
That's a kid.
He's a young man. He's still got his silver hair, though.
Yep, he does.
That's his trademark. He's got a...
But basically, this is kind of a day in the life of Cable.
On Krakoa.
He starts out in what is called the Quarry, which is basically the new arena for fighting on Krakoa. They're like sparring matches.
Nothing cultish about them. They just have an arena. But honestly, it takes the place of like the Danger Room.
Yeah.
And it's clearly like they go there to like let off steam and have matches.
And
it's like if they had a fight club or something.
Yes. It kind of is.
Yep. Still cult-like? But it starts out with a match between Cable and Wolverine.
I mean, that's pretty notable.
And I have to say,
you can't mess around with the old man, the toughest old man of them all.
I have to say, as
or
silly as
you.
I mean, this should be a pretty quick fight. Wolverine would kick his ass, honestly. However,
but does he?
Cable uses some guile and some techniques that I thought were interesting. I always appreciate when they do a little bit more than just the Wolverine punches Cable or stabs him with his claws.
Yeah,
they show another facet of the character for using sure. his intelligence.
So remind me, because I don't know Cable that well. He appears to have like telekinesis.
He has telekinesis.
Is that all his powers are?
Yes. Okay. Telekinesis, and then war
and guns.
War. All guns and kind of like.
Tactical know-how,
yes.
Oh, does his younger self have all of that stuff still?
Yeah, he does. Know-how and future weapons and things like that. Plus, he's been bartering weapons with the Shi'ar, so he's getting cooler weapons.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, it opens sort of with that, and then
kind of... You have to quick mention that there's a little thing afterwards that's like the scorecard after the end of the match that shows like the last dozen matches... Who was in them, who won, and if there was any, like, weird technicalities.
I like the fact that Pyro keeps trying to fight people and always freaking loses. He fought Callisto, which Callisto is, like, super high on the win list. But, yeah, he fought that, and he fought Wolfsbane, and Wolfsbane kicked his ass.
Can anybody use their powers? Like, wouldn't Pyro just burn them to cinders?
I don't know.
Is it a fist fight?
It's usually sort of like a fist fight or some
Wolverine
sort
had
of...
his claws out and
does,
stuff.
But... They basically say that he shouldn't have been able to use his telekinesis, but Silver Samurai is the person who runs this.
I guess the idea is that you use whatever your kind of hand-to-hand powers are, if you've got them.
Although there was a match between Dazzler and Jubilee, so I was like...
I mean, they probably both know how to fight, but they're not known for it.
But I bet that was the
It was like
the
that Xander
thing.
Harmony fight in Buffy.
Aww. A slap fight.
Nah, Jubilee grew up in dilapidated malls. I'm sure she knows how to fight.
Yeah.
Pretty scrappy.
Yeah, somebody tries to take her purse, she's going to whoop up on
them. Yeah, bit Dazzler's ear off, Mike Tyson style.
There are a couple of these fights I would actually have liked to see, like a Rogue and Havoc. I think that'd be kind of a fun...
She's super strong.
Yeah, but Havoc is...
But if he can't use his blasts...
It's true.
We're going to have to talk to Jerry Duggan about the exact rules.
But Dave, do you remember when Havoc was running around? You don't remember this. Nick does. Nick, you remember when Havoc used to run around in Australia and he was all ripped?
Yeah.
He'd probably fight.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure. Okay, so, but that's just the intro
of
the book.
That's the intro. That's like the cold open.
You'd like to spend 5 minutes on the fight club of the island.
I think it's a fun idea.
Well, I think that
gets more interesting.
Although I am not the super into this run, one of the things, when they do their little infographic pages and stuff, it does give you stuff to chew on.
Yeah.
And that was the whole point of it.
But that was the cold open. The big story begins with basically a young mutant getting lost on the island and venturing into a territory they're not supposed to be in. Which is, in X-Men number 2, another island...
merged with Krakoa.
Had island sex, and they became one.
Yes. I was trying to make it sound cool, but Nick...
No, we're just going straight crazy.
But that island had, like, creatures on it and stuff like that, so now there's, like, sections of Krakoa that have, like, monsters or something.
Yep, and this mutant got lost in that, sort of drawn out by something, and it is a giant beastie, and Cable gets to fight it.
Yep.
Which leads into some interesting things. There's definitely some setup for...
He's kind of like a little team. Are they going to be his regular team, or is that just who went out with him?
I think it's just who went out with him, although I like the sort of juxtaposition between him and Armor, because Cable actually, like, recruited Armor into X-Force. So I thought that was kind of a cool idea. There's some setup for Jonathan Hickman's crazy sword thing.
Right, for those who don't know, there's going to be like this crossover between the X-Books that wherein a lot of these the mutants are getting various magical swords of some sort.
That have some connection to the Marvel Universe.
Right, like...
So weird.
Everything
it
from
is a bizarre thing.
The Masamune sword that Wolverine's got to the, like, I'm sure, like, the psychic sword of Psylocke or something like
that.
Yes. Like there's all sorts of different ones showing up. Why, we don't know exactly.
This sword, I'm not going to reveal its origins, because I think it's kind of a crazy thing.
It's a deep cut from Marvel history.
But I like it. I like that Jerry Duggan, who has been doing great things in Marauders, is utilizing a lot of the Marvel Universe. And
the concept that it calls back goes, I think, was kicked off, at least, at around 1980.
Yeah.
So
there is a backup little story, kind of a stinger, that has some possible, that will add some kinks into the story. But I thought it was
Cyclops, Wolverine, and Jean were adding some kinks into their story.
It's true. But it was a really fun first issue.
That sounds like it gives you a fair amount to chew on again.
Other things on my stack this week include two other X-Books, The New Mutants, which sees the return of the MLF, and a new mutant showing up in Russia, which is interesting. And then X-Men number 8, which is basically the X-Men versus the Brood.
Hasn't Russia, by the way, been sort of a...
It's been a big thing.
They've been kind of oppressive, especially towards
the mutants. Yeah, they basically have blocked all of the Krakoa gates and have, are rounding up mutants. And
that's actually true in our world, too.
It's true.
It is a barely veiled thing.
And then X-Men number 8 is all about the Brood showing up on Krakoa in a very cool fashion. I love the Brood, and this is one where they're not really punked out. It is very much a good Brood story.
Are they creepy?
They are.
Okay.
Then Thor number 4, which I think we all have been enjoying.
Yep.
This is sort of a confrontation between Thor and Sif, which does not go in the way you think it will go.
Yep.
I thought it was great. Then there's Jonathan Hickman's new book, Decorum, which has stunning art by Mike Huddleston, who we were trying to earlier figure out what the name of that book that he and Phil Hester did.
The Coffin?
The Coffin. That's what it was. But yeah, his art is gorgeous, and it is Hickman being the most Hickman he can be.
Yep.
Then there's...
There are graphs.
There are many graphs. Star Wars Darth Vader number 2. The last one ended with Darth Vader being confronted by Padme, alive and well.
Yeah. The way this plays out makes so much sense. I'm almost mad at myself for not figuring it out beforehand.
Is it what we talked about, Nick?
It was.
It makes so much sense.
Yeah. When I flipped the first page, I was like, I wonder if that's the case. And I told Dave, and I'm like,
God, yep. It makes so much sense that I can't believe I didn't see it coming.
But it's really good.
I was like, is this like a shape changer, like Zam Wessel?
Yes.
But I don't want to say exactly what.
But Greg Pak has done some really cool stuff with it. Then there is Ant-Man number 3. Which sees Ant-Man team up with Black Cat and Spider-Man. And it's pretty funny. Also, the Avengers show up. I love this book by Zeb Wells. It's a lot of fun. That is everything on my pile. Dave?
Let's see. We're at the halfway point of Warren Ellis's Batman miniseries called Batman's Grave. This was another... He is, like, doing, like, big action scenes in all of these. And this actually... About half the book is a big old action scene that feels like you're fighting. It's literally an Arkham Asylum. He's fighting his way through stuff, and Wernell is having a lot of fun choreographing that for Brian Hitch to draw. And the second half goes deepens in the mystery stuff with some good character bits with both Gordon and Batman. Gordon and Alfred bouncing off Batman. It's interesting to see Warren Ellis's take on that, but I'm still continuing to enjoy that. There's a big 100-page Judge Dredd special, kind of like an annual. It's like it's really like a little anthology of stories. Actually, for 100 pages, $6 is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean that's a standard 100-page giant price now.
I guess so. But yeah, if you're like haven't been reading Judge Dredd stuff in a while and you just want to kind of like you know get your feet wet and read a few stories, this is a good buy.
Are they all new stories or are they?
Yeah, it's not like reprints or anything like that.
100 pages of satirical fascism from the future of Britain.
That's about right. And I just wanted to mention, although I have not had a chance to read it yet, there's a little prose mystery novel that's like in a sort of Scooby-Doo verse stuff. Oh, it's actually put out by Scholastic. That it stars Daphne and Velma teaming up to solve a crime, just the two of them. It's called The Vanishing Girl. And I noticed that it was written in the style, that sort of same device that the Game of Thrones books do, which is alternating chapters of different characters. So one chapter by Daphne, one chapter by Velma. You get both their perspectives. It seems like this is more like a sort of a Nancy Drew-ish type mystery, a little bit more serious than the show, but not like grimdark or anything like that. So it seems like it'd be kind of a cool thing for a kid or young adult. And the cover looks kind of cool. It sort of, I feel like it kind of gives it a little bit of a modern look. It looks cool.
Just got two more to add on. Just Punisher Soviet number 5, which is the penultimate issue of the Garth Ennis, Jason Burroughs miniseries. And the latest issue of Immortal Hulk number 32, which this book continues to be great. This is like, this and Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil are these books that are sort of consistently great. Not a lot of people are talking about them, but honestly, they are like the top of the line of what Marvel's producing right now.
I love that cover of Mortal
it's
Hulk.
It's really good. It's got Zeb Nu.
Zemnu the Titan holding up a dollar bill, but Hulk is on the dollar bill and exploding out of the dollar bill. What is even happening?
They're doing a really interesting bit where Zemnu has basically bamboozled the entire planet into thinking he's the Hulk and he's a good guy.
Uh-huh.
And that his show, Zemnu's Magical World, was a thing they all loved when they were kids. And it's sort of about... What are they? Because
that sounds like one of those weird urban legend type things.
Berenstein.
So Leonard Sampson is the Mandela effect.
Yeah.
So Leonard Sampson talks with one of the doctors in here about it, and he talks about the Mandela effect, and he's like, "Name for Nelson Mandela," which I didn't know this. Name for Nelson Mandela. A number of people remember his funeral happened in the '80s, long before he died.
Oh, interesting.
So that is where the Mandela effect comes back.
Weird.
And he talks about Jiffy Peanut Butter, the Genie movie, Mirror Mirror on the Wall. And the Magic Planet being one of those. It's an interesting use of a real thing. And without giving too much away, since the Hulk has been, various personalities have been showing up, like all the Hulks exist in the Hulk now.
Yeah.
There is a version that shows up in this one, and I'm very excited to see what happens next.
Ooh, neat.
So yeah, it's such a good book.
Is Doc Samson being handled well?
Doc Samson's being handled very well.
Cool.
Yeah.
I had come to really like that character.
Yeah,
so.
Basically throughout all this, they've got Doc Samson, a reborn Rick Jones, Betty, Banner, some other people sort of all running their own little operation. It's a good book.
Nice. To be going strong after 32 issues is no mean feat.
Yep. All right, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, hopefully a little more rested until that time.
Go Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.